This show is brought to you by SeatGeek, the perfect place to buy and sell tickets. Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific podcast for you today. A finals preview. Brian Scalabrine, The Vertical, Comcast Sportsnet, SiriusXM NBA. He joins me as we look back to Game 7 between the Warriors and Thunder and look ahead to the rematch, Golden State-Cleveland, one more time. That's next, Vertical Podcast, Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Well, I know the Super Bowl is widely considered the biggest event in sports, but for my money, there's nothing better than Game 7s, either in a conference finals, an NBA finals, a Stanley Cup final. I love Game 7s, and we got a good one on Monday night between Oklahoma City and Golden State. Game 7, Golden State knocks off the Thunder, completing a 3-1 comeback, and now the Golden State Warriors move on in a rematch with the Cleveland Cavaliers in the NBA Finals. And who better to bring in to talk about that? Brian Scalabrine from The Vertical, Comcast Sportsnet, SiriusXM. You can find him everywhere. What's up, Scal?
Mannix, thanks for having me on your show, bud.
I always appreciate your time, man. Look, hey, one thing I want to ask you first is, you know, you were out in Golden State, and I don't want to say it's the fledgling stages of Steph Curry, but the early stages of Steph before he became Steph Curry, you know, Superman, two-time MVP. When you saw him and were working with him kind of up close and personal, what did you kind of project him to be? I mean, I guess how surprised are you he's turned into this kind of player?
Well, when I was there, I was very high on Steph, even before I took the job. Steph Curry was amazing in that Denver series and even in that San Antonio series the year before I went to Golden State. And I thought once I got there and I saw him, I thought he was a pass, like a pocket pass away from being an MVP, which an ability to get rid of the ball without turning it over at a high clip. And you know, with and obviously Draymond being there helped a ton because Draymond's such a great playmaker, but just his ability to score and shoot was like something I have never seen before. And pick up, no matter what the score was, 9-2 playing to 11, he would find a way to win. He'd come back. And it wouldn't just be making shots, which we all know he does that. It was ball, off the ball plays, coming up with steals, come up with a big rebound or a big offensive rebound. So I knew he had the potential to do it. It's just a matter of him being able to get rid of the ball and trust his teammates and be able to do that without turning the ball over 4 or 5 times a game. But he had that sort of gunslinger attitude, which at the time really helped him sometimes and really hurt him on the other end. But I went out and said it as soon as I was let go and sort of got back in the media. I said, I think Steph Curry's going to be the MVP of the league one year.
You know, we get caught up in the moment sometimes, and it's hyperbole sometimes. But, you know, watching him last night, it sort of like makes you remember that there almost is no comparison for this guy, Scal. I mean, I watch him play, and it's like he's playing Papa Shot on 7-footers. Like, I'm watching Ibaka and Adams and even Cantor at times step out and defend him, and I'm not looking at their defense saying that's really bad defense. Steph is just releasing his shot from exactly where you're not supposed to release it from, like the chest, and he's doing things I don't think any player ever has really done. I mean, can you make a comparison with him? Is he just a new mold out there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we've ever seen a player like him. But you know what the funny thing is? Like, we can all understand, you know, a guard. Let's say you use Tony Parker, for example, a guy who drives the ball to the basket, and he's going against, you know, a big-time shot blocker like Dwight Howard or DeAndre Jordan, and he puts the ball up an extra foot because of a shot blocker. But no one in their right mind can actually imagine a guy in the middle of Game 6 and 7 changing his shot or changing the trajectory of his shot so he can get it over a 7-foot defender who's all in his face. Like, we have never, ever seen that. The idea of changing your shot from 26 feet out is mind-boggling to every NBA player out there, but Steph Curry somehow seems to, like, figure it out. And that's the whole thing with him. You know, whether last season, you know, they're down 2-1 to Memphis, the Golden State Warriors and Steph Curry just figured it out, whether they were down 2-1 to Cleveland. Everyone can point to, oh, LeBron, he just got tired. But, man, how about the Warriors just figuring it out and figuring out what the other team is doing and ultimately right now down 3-1 and then once again making different changes, not a big changes, but once again figuring it out, whether I got to change my shot, get a shot off quicker, catch and shoot, play with more aggressiveness, go to the basket more. The Warriors just figure it out, and I think it's a lot, and a lot has to do with their leader, Steph Curry, just figures it out.
Yeah, and he's got such – an ideal sidekick in Klay Thompson. And one of the things that's always impressed me, at least for the last 2 years, about Klay is kind of the humility and the understanding of what kind of situation that he's in. I mean, I remember talking to Klay early this season and asking him, like, you know, Klay, I mean, we've seen superstars playing together not work out. You're a guy that could easily be the franchise player somewhere else. Do you think you're ever going to get to that point? And he kind of shrugged. He's like, man, I just love winning too much. And when you have that type of attitude, I mean, easily, I think Klay Thompson, 20 to 23 teams in the NBA, he might be the best player on. He seems perfectly comfortable. What was there anything about his personality that you noted that makes him so willing to accept kind of the second fiddle role when he really is a first banana somewhere else?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really know how he does that or what his mindset is. You think about it, Chris. You know, like, everyone in the NBA wants to be the man. They want to be on commercials and all that. Like, Klay is really not like that. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, everyone in the NBA wants to get paid and they want to make as most money. But, you know, that whole thing about, like, man, I got to get my respect. It's kind of like Russell Westbrook laughing at Steph Curry. Like, he wants his respect. Or LeBron sort of, you know, shunning Steph Curry being the MVP. He wants his respect. Everybody in the NBA sort of wants their due and they think that they're the best player. How about Klay Thompson? Yeah, you're right. He is the perfect fit for Steph Curry. How about him getting credit for being one of the best two guards in the NBA? Yeah, you can point to James Harden, his unbelievable season last season, and, you know, he could score. But, man, is there a better two-way two-guard out there right now in the NBA? And when you say a perfect compliment, like, obviously he could shoot and Steph could shoot too, but Steph does all the ball handling. Klay can have the ball in his hands for a total of 5-6 seconds a game and score 25 points because his catch-and-shoot is so fast. So, I don't think there's a better two-guard for him. And his personality is completely laid back. I mean, it really is interesting when a guy gets drafted to the Golden State Warriors. Like, maybe Steph Curry would be a megastar everywhere he went. But I think Klay Thompson is really in the perfect place for him, not just from the basketball standpoint, but just the whole personality of the organization and the Bay Area. It really does suit his personality.
A couple of years ago, there was talk that Klay might be flipped for Kevin Love. That was when Minnesota was putting him on the block, and, you know, Cleveland ultimately came in. But that was something that was seriously discussed between those two teams. Back then, what did you think? Did you think highly enough of Klay Thompson then that you thought that deal might be crazy, or was that something you would have made if you were the Warriors?
No, you know what? I mean, to be honest with you, I thought I would have made the deal. I thought Kevin Love at the time was playing at an unbelievable level. It would have been the wrong deal. I mean, it really would have been a catastrophic deal. I don't know how good Kevin Love would have played in the Bay Area. Maybe he would have. He'd be somewhat like he was in Minnesota. But, you know, what I wasn't, and I was there that year. I was coaching him, but it was hard for me to get a bead on Klay with the type of offense that we ran. It was just a lot of isolations, a lot of, you know, like isolations at the elbow, back downs. And, you know, that's not Klay's strong suit. His strong suit is his unbelievable conditioning, his ability to move around, and he only needs a sliver of space. Well, if Klay's just standing in a corner somewhere, it was really hard to get an idea of how great Klay was. Now, I knew he was great on the defensive end, but I kind of just thought that. And then I didn't realize the emergence of Draymond Green. Obviously, at the time, Draymond Green was just a backup power forward. So by those two things, by not making that move, you allow Draymond Green to be one of the best power forwards in the game, and then you still get Klay Thompson. So, yeah, I mean, I would have been fired five times over for making that move. And, ultimately, I'm really happy for Bob Myers that he didn't make that move because, you know, like, I'm looking at Kevin Love at 26 and 13 thinking, man, him and Steph together would be unbelievable. But, you know, like, that would have been a mistake.
How many times have we seen that, though, Scal? Even in Boston, where we both do some work. I mean, Danny Ainge last year trying to get into the top 10 in the draft to move up and grab a Justice Winslow. The Brooklyn pick, which is now incredibly valuable on the table. It really is true that the deals you don't make are oftentimes the best deals you could possibly make.
They really are, right? I mean, you know, especially if you're trying to, here's the hard part about GMs, right? If you're swinging for the fences, you're going to strike out, and that hurts. I really, and you could tell me, and you're like dialed into these guys, Chris, but I really feel like a lot of GMs are like, man, I don't want to, if I make this move and it doesn't work out, I get fired. I think they're almost afraid of getting fired, which, don't believe me, I'd be afraid of getting fired too. I think that's a great job to have, being a GM of the team, and you get to sort of make a couple million bucks a year doing it. But I really feel there's a lot of GMs like there. Just for instance, let's just use Charlotte for not making that deal. They take Kaminsky over getting, it wasn't just Winslow. It wasn't just the third pick. It was some other things too. So that deal really could, if Charlotte, just think about their year. You know, Frank Kaminsky was good. Okay, fine, I get it. But just think about their year. If they could be sitting on the number three pick and have some cap space, the future would be bright for them. So really, they should have made that move, and they didn't.
I think a lot of GMs, in a broad sense, are gun-shy and risk-averse. And that can apply to trades. And I think it's also applicable, you know, and it's kind of timely with this year, is that's taking a risk on assistant coaches. You don't often see assistant coaches getting jobs. This year you do. This year you had, you know, Sean Marks hiring Kenny Atkinson. You had Memphis grabbing David Fizdale. You've had assistant coaches elevated more this year than I can recently remember. And I attribute that, Scalad, and maybe you don't have an opinion on this as an ex-assistant coach. I just think GMs are afraid to hire a guy who doesn't have a body of work, who they don't know, you know, what he's all about. Will players respect him? What kind of system is he going to run? They're more comfortable hiring the guy that's been fired three times in the past than they are giving a chance to a guy that's proven himself as an assistant coach.
Well, it'd be interesting if you really broke down. I'd really want to know what a former head coach is asking for and what an assistant coach is asking for. You know, an assistant coach that's never had his shot is maybe asking for less money, and ownership is willing to do that. But, you know, maybe you're right in the sense, hey, maybe let's give a guy, like some of these assistant coaches now are like sort of like no-brainer hires. Like, all right, you know, he checks all the right boxes. He's going to be the guy. So, you know, I think that really, like, owners, GMs making that call about assistant coaches to become a head coach has got to be the hardest call to make, because that little 16, 18-inch move to your right or left, that's a big, big move. And not a lot of people can do that.
Yeah, it's tough, and a lot of guys have failed. But you know, when you get that right guy, man, it's impressive. When that guy pans out, you look like a genius.
You're like the guy that did all the work and find the diamond in the rough. You know, like, you recycle a head coach. It's like, yeah, of course. If he's had some success in the past. It's the players. But you get an assistant coach, and he knocks it out of the park. All of a sudden, you look just, like, unbelievable, which is really why I can keep on beating this drum is, why would Chicago get rid of Tom Thibodeau?
No, I don't know.
I don't understand it.
I don't know. How you give up a coach that extracts. Yeah, that's a whole different conversation. Maybe we should have it with Tibbs sometime, the three of us on the air. See about
Yeah, if we can get a call back from Tibbs. Ever since he became the president, man, it's like he's like Barack Obama texts me back now. I can't get anything from Tibbs.
You know, watching that game last night, I feel like I learned something about Golden State in this series, because no matter what Steve Kerr said, they didn't really face adversity last year. Like the Memphis series, Mike Conley had a broken face in that series. Like they didn't, that wasn't adversity. Even Cleveland.
But not taking anything away from them, right?
No.
We're not taking anything away from them. But, listen, a cakewalk's a cakewalk. Who cares? You won the championship. You know what? It doesn't mean it wasn't a cakewalk.
Yeah, and even Cleveland, you know, being up 2-1, I still thought they had control of that series. This being down 3-1 to a peer, I mean, Oklahoma City at that point was a peer. And the way they dismantled Golden State in those two games, I mean, did you learn something new about the Warriors based on what you saw in these last three games?
Yeah, here's what I learned. I learned that Steve Kerr ultimately has to and wants to trust that small lineup no matter what, right? And so, you know, like I went out there and you know, I did the thing on the vertical saying they're going to come back, but here's how they're going to do it. They're going to go small. You know, that small lineup got completely shellacked in 3 and 4. I mean, it was embarrassing, the small lineup. But ultimately, you feel like the only way for them to win is for them to go small. But when you go small, you also have to play well. You can't just go small, right? So I was like, listen, you're going to go small and Draymond's going to play well and Steph Curry's going to play well. And that has to happen for these guys to win. But I'm going to go out there and say, if they do that, they are going to win. And that's what they did. They went small. And ultimately, they do give up offensive rebounds, which is odd why Donovan didn't play Steven Adams more minutes. But, hey, it's for a different conversation. But ultimately, they open up the floor, and now Steph Curry has the ability to go to the basket, which at that point makes him more unguardable than he was before. So, ultimately, if you're going to beat them, and you're going to stay big, whatever big is for Cleveland, which I'm not even sure that what it is now with LeBron at the four. If you're going to go big against Golden State, You better have some type of rim protection and just leave someone else open. Because if you go small and you try to check everybody, Steph Curry's going to cook you.
Yeah, and look, about Oklahoma City and Billy Donovan, to get back to what you just said there, I have been giving Billy Donovan a lot of credit through the San Antonio series, even through the first couple of games of this Warriors series, but I just thought he got away, you know, from what made them successful up until that point. Like, you go back to game one, that win, Cantor was on the floor, Adams was on the floor. It just didn't seem, as this series progressed, like Billy trusted them enough. And I firmly believe, Scal, that, you know, regular season coaching, like, you separate yourself end of games, fourth quarter type of situations. Postseason coaching, you also do that. But substitution patterns are even more important in postseason coaching, because you've got to know how much to trust your young guys and how much to ride your big stars. I think that's a critical decision-making process for coaches, and I didn't love what Billy did late in that series.
Yeah, see, that's exactly right. I'm glad that you brought that up, because I hate the general media. I would say, like, anybody in the lower median, right, that says, oh, what's the adjustments? What's the adjustments? At the end of the day, all adjustments are based on roster moves, like substitution patterns and who's playing and matching up against who. So you have to decide, right? If you put Steven Adams in there and he has that body of work through the series and he doesn't get a couple rebounds, you know, in 3 or 4 minutes, or just to say a minute and a half, you got to just believe, like, all right, you know, he's good, he's Steven Adams. Eventually, it's going to pay off. Just like Steve Kerr said, all right, listen, I know this lineup wasn't good in games 3 and 4, but in game 6, I'm going to go with it because that's just what I do and that's who I trust. And somehow my gut tells me I got to go with this small lineup. Somehow, I bet you, if you really like put Billy Donovan to a polygraph and you said, do you wish you played Steven Adams more in that series? Like, yeah, I really do. I really wish I did, because that ultimately is going to be, I think, the reason why they lost. Listen, they could have kept Steven Adams in there and still lost. My point is, Steven Adams at that point has dominated in probably the first 5 games. You got to just roll the dice with the guys who have been playing well.
Steven Adams is going to be an all-star. That's my hot take prediction of the podcast.
But wait, I want to know one thing. I'm going to ask you now. It's my podcast. I'm asking you. What is OKC going to do now that they paid Cantor $17 million? Ibaka's up next year. Durant will probably opt in, whatever, and be up next year. Russell Westbrook, Adams, they can't pay them all, right?
I think you have to. And I think you got to pay Dion Waiters, too. I think you pay everybody.
So
I
like
think
a $200 million payroll?
Yeah, yeah.
Five max guys. But let's see. Cleveland has LeBron, Kyrie, Kevin Love, Tristan Thompson. I mean, can you have five or like 5.5 max players?
One thing I know from talking to the front office people in Oklahoma City is that they believe, and this is what they're saying anyway, that the fiscal responsibility they had up until this point, you know, the cost cutting, the whole James Harden thing a few years ago where they didn't want to pay the full max and that ultimately cost them, which is probably the biggest mistake of the Sam Presti era. All that savings has led to this point where we're willing and able to just splurge on everybody. They're willing to spend as much as they need to spend to keep this roster intact. That's what they're saying anyway, Scal. Who knows what they actually do, but that's at least what they're saying right now.
So let me ask you this question. Cantor, movable or not movable? I'm not sure.
Not at that money and not at this time. I mean, maybe a year from now when it's, what, like 2 years left on the deal at like 35 or whatever it is, maybe that's a more movable contract, especially 2 years from now, or a year from now anyway, when that cap goes up to $110 million, because then it's not going to look quite so bad.
Yeah, okay. Well, it just seems like, I, you know, at the time you have to pay Cantor, but really you don't. If you really have Steven Adams there and you believe in him, you don't have to pay Cantor. But at the end of the day, if Cantor's making 17, he's playing 14 minutes in the playoffs, and Steven Adams is dominating, you have to pay Steven Adams max money.
Yeah, and don't you think, too, that, I mean, I don't know if Durant's going to do this. He more strikes me as the guy that when he's ready to settle on a team, and that might not be this summer, but when he's ready to settle on a team, he's going to go the full five. But if Durant does what LeBron's been doing, the whole 1+1 stuff, which is well within his rights as a guy with a Nike contract worth way more than what his NBA contract's going to be worth.
Yeah, you're right.
It's well within, I mean, like, he can put real pressure on the Thunder by doing this. I mean, he can do what LeBron's doing and make them pay, or else they run the risk of losing him.
Well, I think he has to do 1+1 up until the year where you don't feel like you can do it anymore. Then you bank out the $5 million, but the 5 years. But you know, I mean, after all this, Russell Westbrook is still a wild card. Yeah, I mean, he doesn't care what anybody thinks. He doesn't care. I mean, I can see him just bolting, and he's the kind of guy that believes, like, man, whoever I go will win. I mean, so he can go to the Knicks, the Lakers, and they can win three games, and he's like, ah, we'll be a playoff team. So I think Durant has to watch out for what Westbrook does, which means it makes the most sense for him to do the 1+1. But if he does the 1+1, does this, like, mean the next summer everyone's talking about the Durant sweepstakes, like in Boston? Do I got to talk about this for another year?
Well, it moves the needle, right? Everyone wants to talk about this. You could. I get no better Boston traffic than when I write about Durant and the possibility the Celtics could sign him.
You can actually track your traffic, like where people click from.
Well, we do it here at Yahoo. It's a website.
I love
that. How
I
it
mean,
is.
Every time I talk Durant, I end up on Yahoo's front page. It's amazing.
Oh, my God. All right, hang tight for me for 1 second, Scal. I want to talk to my listeners here about Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They support a more sustainable food system. Beef is raised humanely. Chickens are free range. Pork is raised naturally. You get the idea. Eat better food for less. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the very best. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with the pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes every week. In June, Blue Apron's got spicy Korean rice cakes with snow peas and pea shoots, spicy and sweet chili ponzu catfish, and green beans with coconut ginger rice, New England-style salmon rolls with roasted potatoes and chives. There's no weekly commitment, so only get deliveries when you want them. Check out this week's menu and get your free two meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Mannix. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Mannix. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So
no, seriously, Mannix, I love Blue Apron. Like, I'm not just pumping your product.
I really? I just started getting it.
It's ridiculously good. You know why? Because, like, who wants to go out to eat? You can make that stuff at home, and it's better than even going out.
But see, here's my thing. I live in New York, Scal. Who wants to cook?
Yeah, that's tough, man. That's tough. You know what? You bring a lady over. The instructions are so easy that you bang it out, and then, like, you know, like, my wife, I could cook a whole meal for my wife and family, and they think I'm just like the man, but it's all Blue Apron. It's all like there's pictures. You know, I don't know how to read, so it's pictures everywhere. It's
great. my problem is, Scal, I've still got to, I have to make my stove no longer a storage closet.
New York's a beast, man. I have so much respect for you for making it there, man. Like, I live out in the burbs, man. My kids aren't going to do anything out here.
I think there's, like, a baseball glove in there from, like, the 1990s. It's just been so long in this New York City.
I'll do the read next time. I love Blue Apron.
Perfect.
I really do.
So, you're right, Scal. Boston fired up about Kevin Durant. Just fired up about this free agency. And you know this from talking to people in Boston. Like, ownership, general manager, coach, they're all fired up about this. I think they might be just as fired up as the fan base is.
Yeah, I mean, they have to be watching the OKC game and saying, why are these guys winning?
Yeah.
We're losing our opportunity to sign him. But I will say this. It doesn't, even if they don't get Kevin Durant, doesn't it seem like something's going to go down in Boston? I just feel like something's going to go down. I feel like there's going to be some type of big moves out there and sort of, you know, like, the Celtics got a bazillion picks, so it seems like something is going to happen with those bazillion picks. I just don't know what it's going to be. And you know, I was watching after OKC got beat by the Spurs by 41. I'm thinking, this KD is coming, but I don't know if that's going to happen anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think Danny Ainge would lose his mind if nothing happens this summer. I mean, you can't draft eight guys, right?
No, you can't. You made all those trades to get all those second-round picks, and you don't even have roster spots. So it's something has to happen. But, I mean, you let me know. Are GMs hesitant to do deals with Danny?
No, I don't think it scares them off because, look, Danny, I mean, look, we go back to last year. He tried to make that deal, you know, giving up the Brooklyn pick. So he's made some great deals, but he's kind of been lucky in some ways that some of them didn't get made because without that, you know, I mean, Justice Winslow, very good player, don't get me wrong, but I think, Scal, I'd rather have the assets they were going to give up rather than Justice Winslow right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how good Justice Winslow will be. I think he's, you know, for Brad's system, he seems like a pretty good player, a hard-nosed defensive player. But, you know, what that third pick is going to become, is it going to become an asset that you can trade? Are you just going to make the pick? Is it going to be Bender? I have no idea. That's the thing. Right now, if it was one or two, it would be so much easier to do my job. But at three, everything is up in the air.
I saw Brandon Ingram this week. I went out to upstate New York to watch him work out. You know, tremendous-looking shooter, skinny as a rail. I don't know if I've ever seen a prospect that skinny.
Well, I mean, you saw Tayshaun Prince, right?
I think he's skinnier than Tayshaun Prince. I mean,
really?
He honestly looks like a size 30 waist.
Oh, man, that's like, not good.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, you tell me, like, you know, how important is that for developing a guy physically? Because Durant, I mean, he gets compared to Durant, and physically I guess there are some comparisons there, but I don't know. I mean, how skinny is too skinny for a guy?
When did you see him work out with another person?
No, he was just shooting around. I mean,
man,
just
that's
doing.
Hard to do, man. That is so hard to do. Like, it's really easy for me now. I'm not saying I get everybody right, but I just look for separation. Like, who separates when they elevate, when they go up for a shot? And there are guys like, you know, like who's this guy? Maker?
Thon Maker, yeah.
No separation. Like, he's going against like sophomores from high school in the suburbs and not separating. So, like, you have to be able to create separation. If you don't separate in whatever, college or one-on-one, you won't separate in the league. So it's hard for me when I watch Ingram because I'm watching, you know, just clips, and I'm not seeing him separate as much. So the strength really does come when you need to create that separation. Two bodies collide, boom, and now you elevate, and now you create separation. Steph Curry, he doesn't do it with body contact. He does it with fancy dribbling and footwork. So one way or another, you got to create separation to get your shot off.
Yeah, and you can get man strength off. You don't. I mean, people get attached to bulk. They're like, wait, how much weight did he gain? Like, how big? It's like the ultimate, like, sports writers, their blanket, like their security blanket. Like, well, he gained 22 pounds this summer.
Like, that's good, right? It's not all good. You know?
No, that doesn't always matter, right? I mean, when you're looking at a guy getting bigger, you can get stronger. Like Durant, I mean, he's bigger than what he was when he came out of Texas, but it's not like he's turned into this Adonis over the last 6 years.
No. You know, but here's the thing. It's another thing you can also look at is, like, does he have wide hips or narrow hips? Like, here's a good example. You know, Joakim Noah, right? Like, two teammates of mine. Joakim Noah is a beast in the weight room. He works and works and works and works. But he has sort of narrow hips. You know, he's easy to move around. It doesn't mean he's not good and he can't rebound and all that, but you can move him around. He's got a ridiculous motor, which also helps him. Carlos Boozer is a guy who never worked. He, like, never lifted weights, doesn't really work out, if he does lift weights, it's like some abs, right? But you can't move Carlos Boozer because he has really, really wide hips. So there's guys like, you know, when we use Porzingis, for example, you know, he comes in, his upper body looks really frail, but he's got these wide hips, and that gives him a good base. Does Ingram have wide hips or narrow hips? If they're narrow hips, then it's going to be hard for him. Like, even Tayshaun Prince, as skinny as he was, he's also another guy that has wide hips that's hard to move.
What were you in the weight room? Were you the ab guy, too?
No, I was like, everyone wondered, what's wrong with you? You always lifting weights, but you never got any cuts. Like, I'm in there all the time, and I never got any cuts. I got bigger, I got stronger, but I never got any cuts. I mean, I should have took HGH, man.
See, I
would have been a prime candidate for it. You know what I mean? Like, of anybody out there, like, even, like, let's say I got caught, right? They would have been like, yeah, we can understand.
It's okay. See, I figured you for, like, when I was in high school, like, everyone that I, you know, to get your, like, beach body for the summer, like, you'd do ab work, and then you'd do toe raises or calf raises.
Nothing, man. No matter what I did, man, no cuts. Like, now I work out like a beast. By the way, I just did hill sprints, right? And I'm like, just before I do this podcast, it doesn't matter. Never, ever am I ever going to have cuts, man. Never going to have cuts. And some guys, like, listen, Paul Pierce, he never had cuts either.
Nope.
But he's strong. He's pretty good. So not everybody, we call them in the NBA, we call them whack bodies. We just got a whack body. Some guys in the NBA just got whack bodies. No matter how many minutes we play or how much we work, we just got whack bodies.
Who is the most whack body guy you came across?
No, but see, you have to be good. Like Boris Diaw is whack body, first team all whack body. Like Paul Pierce is first team all time greatest whack body ever. You know, like those guys, like, you know, like they say Baron Davis, you know, Darren Williams, those guys are part of the whack body crew, but not really. Jason Kidd has been labeled as sometimes a whack body, not really cut up, but, you know, all those guys are incredible shape and they're good players, but, you know, like, they're just not cut up. They're just not ripped up.
And another time, we're going to have to do whack body, like top 10 whack bodies, at
least. Oh, we have to, like Boris Diaw is the MVP of the whack body. He's actually the leader and the president of the whack body crew.
I feel like this is a Mamba minute here for the vertical.
It probably is. They probably are shocked by the idea. They're actually the group of people that just have whack bodies that are in the NBA. What we should do is look at the guys who have like amazing bodies that don't make it.
Like
Robinson, right? The guy should be an all-star every year. How is he not an all-star?
Oh, I see so many of those guys at the combine. Who is it? The kid from a kid from North Texas, maybe, or Tony something, who is like built
Tony
like
Tony Mitchell.
Tony Mitchell, yeah, built like a truck.
How do you not make it, man? Like, how do I play 11 years and you get like two and a half? How does that work?
You get seduced by it too, Scal. I go to those combines and I start writing like, well, look out for Tony Mitchell. He is a real up and comer. He bench pressed like 460.
Biggest world mystery has to be how I played 11 years in the
yes.
NBA with my body. It's got to be.
Looking ahead to the finals matchup, Golden State and Cleveland. You were on a lot of those Celtics broadcasts against the Cavaliers, and I want to ask you specifically about Kevin Love and what you think Golden State's going to do to attack him. And is Kevin Love in this series, is he an asset or is he a liability here?
He's an asset for Golden State. No, listen, he can make shots, he can space the floor. But I don't know Kevin Love as a person. I just know people that know Kevin Love. My guess would be he's a little bit afraid of going against in this series. He's a little bit afraid of going against Draymond Green and, you know, having to guard Steph Curry, you know, and if they switch, or having to show on Steph Curry and get back to Draymond Green. I don't know where he's going to fit in. I think really where he ultimately is going to fit in, which Steve Kerr would just go small with Draymond at the five, is at the five with LeBron at the four. So the only thing he can really do is space the floor, but he's got to be shooting at a high clip. It's really going to be the downfall of Cleveland. And my prediction of Kevin Love being on the market is going to happen. It's going to be based off of this series. LeBron's going to be like, come on, Kevin. Like, you got to go somewhere else where you can, you know, you can score your 22, get your 12, and, you know, and be 500.
Based on what you saw, like, you know, Boston plays a heavy dose of pick and roll with Isaiah. Is that kind of a similar game plan for Golden State, which is kind of next level there with the talent they have?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know, like, what T. Lou is going to do. I bet you right now he's up 24/7 trying to figure this out because there is no answer for it. If you switch on Steph Curry, you got Kevin Love on Steph Curry. Now, I'm not one of these guys that like to like make fun of the white guy for not being able to guard. He just doesn't have the length. Like Steven Adams, I know he's not white, he's from New Zealand, but he did a fine job on defense. But Kevin Love, I just don't know. And this is not no knock on him. How is he going to stay with Steph Curry? Or how is he going to show and then get back? I just don't see what he's going to be able to do and how he's going to be able to defend the series. Like, I think Tristan Thompson would probably, you know, have to play heavy, heavy minutes in the series. That's why, like, I give LeBron, like, in my mind, he's going to win two games, like, just because he's LeBron James. But I think Golden State is going to win in seven. I'm not picking them to win in five or anything like that, but I think he's going to win. I think they're going to win game seven. I think they're going to win it kind of handily.
Yeah, and with Kevin Love, it's a tricky situation, I think, for Ty Lue, because if it starts going downhill and you pull him early, like, say, late third, early fourth, and you don't put him back in, I know Kevin's a veteran and he's been around, but you kind of run the risk of losing him for the rest of the series, don't you? If you start showing no confidence in him right away, I mean, I don't know what kind of message that sends to him about his ability to stay in these games.
Yeah, I don't know what to do either. I mean, like, I do not envy T. Lou. He gets to coach the Cavs, who are the greatest team in the Eastern Conference, but like right now against the Warriors, he would have been better off at the Thunder one. I just don't know how he's going to match up with like the lineups that they can throw out there. I just don't know how Kevin Love is going to have an impact in this series. Maybe it's just on the defensive rebounding. Maybe that's it when the Warriors do miss. But there's going to be times where the Warriors are going to go on a 14-4 run, and a lot of those are going to be at the expense of Kevin Love. So, you know, I hope I'm wrong, because I hate to see a guy just get embarrassed out there, but I just really feel like it's going to be one of those things where T. Lou's going to be like, well, I can't play you in the fourth quarter when they're making these runs, and LeBron's going to look at you with that crazy look, and, you know, the offseason's going to happen. I mean, it's going to be bad news for Kevin Love.
All right, I want to ask you about LeBron, but I first got to tell my listeners here about SeatGeek. And if you have been frustrated buying tickets online, SeatGeek is the site for you. Most sites make it complicated, and they all try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. SeatGeek is the only place I ever go to look for tickets to a game or to a concert. I used it recently. It was great. I recommend it highly to everybody. SeatGeek's taking all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. They pull all the tickets available on other sites into one place so you save time and never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticket brokers, they show you the full ticket price range from start to finish and never try to trick you with huge fees in the checkout page. My listeners get a $20 rebate off the first SeatGeek purchase. To get that $20 rebate, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab, and click Add a Promo Code. Enter promo code MANIX. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code MANIX today.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
I've been talking to a few people this week about, you know, LeBron and this finals. And look, you know, his record in the finals, who cares? I mean, 07, they had no shot. They were lucky to even be there against San Antonio. I even give them a little bit of a skate on 2011, because I thought Dallas was the more ready team to win. You know, putting that Miami team together, you know, very rarely, only Boston really from 07-08, team you were on, was equipped to win right away. But this series, Scal, this is kind of no excuse for LeBron. I know we talked about Kevin Love and the issues he might have, but you're talented, you're healthy, you've got all the pieces you wanted around you. I mean, for me, if LeBron, I know they're playing Golden State, but if LeBron loses this series, it is a legitimate point of criticism for him and a legitimate black mark kind of on his resume.
How could you – let me help me with this one. How are you going to give him the Dallas series off when he played awful?
Yeah, no, he did play awful.
You're not
going to
give him this one off?
Like, I'm not giving this one off.
This one.
He's supposed to lose this one?
Yeah. They don't have home court. Golden State won 73 games. I mean, it's going to be another mark on his record, but like – I think the Dallas one is the one that you can pinpoint. I think this one is like, you don't look at the Warriors as like supremely better?
Supremely better, yes, but you know, based on what I saw last year, like LeBron could be the great equalizer in these series just by taking over.
I know, but like you really dive into that series. You got Gritty Grimy, Dellavedova, and Tristan Thompson. Now you're going to get Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving. So the offense is going to be a more beautiful series, but you know, like it's not going to be the same type of LeBron putting the team on his back. He's not going to do that this time around because he doesn't have to because he has more help. But on the defensive end, they're going to get exposed. I mean, that's kind of the way I see. I look at this as like two completely different teams. Like I know it's the same two teams matching up, but the Warriors were young and gun shy, and Steph Curry didn't. You know, he wasn't like how he is right now, where like the rest of the world is like kind of the rest of the NBA players are sort of giving him the backhand to his face when and not calling him, you know, a real MVP. So he has something to prove there. He wants to go out there, and he didn't win the MVP last year. Iguodala won. So I got the like Steph Curry being an animal in this series. Then conversely to that, LeBron's not going to get nearly as many touches. He's not going to be able to drive to the basket. The only thing you can say is, well, LeBron will have more space to work. So he should have a higher shooting percentage because he shot in the 30s. I think 38% in last year's series. So I don't expect them to win this series. I expect it to be close. I think it's just going to be another mark on his resume of like not a guy who can't get over the hump in the finals.
Is the Steph Curry disrespect real? And I go back to the Players Awards, whatever the hell they call those awards.
Those like, are ridiculous.
You know, like are they even happening this year? Because they were so absurd.
No way, they can't happen.
Like it's like
they canceled them. They canceled them an hour before the MVP was announced when no one showed up.
Yeah, I mean, like,
for the following year.
I think Constantine on NBC had a longer run than those awards.
It was so bad. But let's go back to the Steph Curry disrespect, right?
Because Harden got that award. That's why I'm kind of bringing it up. Harden, yeah, like his peers voted Harden.
And you know, like every NBA player, like you interview an NBA player, hey, who do you got for the MVP? Oh, I got James Harden, man. What he's able to do is unbelievable. I don't get the disrespect. Now, maybe because I grew up like in the suburbs, and maybe Steph did too, and he's not from the mean street, and he didn't grow up on the playground. I don't know. Maybe because he grew up in gyms, and his dad's an NBA player, or maybe because the media loves him. Here's another reason: the media absolutely loves Steph, and they think that Steph Curry, not you, obviously, the people well below you as far as basketball knowledge, and well below me, right, of course. But they think that he invented the two-ball dribbling drill. Like, no one's ever done that before. And it's like, and the players are like, man, you guys are, like, you treat Steph Curry like he's some kind of god that invented basketball. And maybe that's the reason why they don't like him. But you know what? They don't like him. And they don't give him respect, and they laugh at him and everything like that. So maybe because he's not big and imposing, he's not going to dunk on you and not going to embarrass you except for just knocking threes and getting 36, 8, and 6 against you. I don't know why they disrespect him.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, and I, look, I'm among the, and I would have voted, I didn't vote this year, but I would have voted Steph Curry for MVP. I still think LeBron is the most dominant player in the game. I mean, his ability to take over, and you saw it last year in the finals, and you've seen it time and again over the course of this season. You know, we call Steph unique, and that's true, but LeBron is, he's a freak. He's a physical freak out there.
Yeah, but is he a physical freak if he can't, if he only can shoot 26% from three?
Yeah, that's a problem.
Like, that's where it's like, I feel like LeBron could be stopped. He could sort of self-check himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't. Steph Curry is not going to self-check himself. If Steph's open, you're shocked when he makes contested threes with a hand in his face. So I know, like, an imposing drive to the basket where someone bounces off you, you dunk it and you flex your muscles, and, you know, that's worth two. But what Steph does is to me is just as incredible, and it's worth three. And not only that, but it opens up the floor for the rest of your teammates as well because everyone's on high alert. So I think Draymond Green would benefit more from playing with Steph than he plays with LeBron. And LeBron, I give him I label him as the player in the NBA that makes the players around him better. But it's just the fact that Steph Curry can shoot the ball makes other people around him better. It's just not directly better, like an assist.
So you think that if Cleveland loses this series, it's not as bad as the 2011 loss?
Besides the cumulative effect of it, it's not as bad, right? Because it's the cumulative effect of LeBron getting there and then losing, and getting there and then losing, and then taking shots at Steph Curry and then losing again. And then last year, like, I'm the best player in the world, and I only have, you know, like, half my team, but now I have my foot. Now, there's no excuses. Now, I'm with you on that. Like, there are no excuses for LeBron James, even though I fully expect him to lose, because the excuse is going to be, how can I win with Kevin Love, man? I can't check anybody out here, which is not a knock on Kevin Love. It's just that, you know, like, he just doesn't have the physical tools to go out there and guard those guys.
You know what I wonder, too, is I wonder if this is the last year before the East starts to catch up, because the second year in a row is just a cakewalk to get to the NBA Finals. How close do you think the Eastern Conference is to at least having somebody pose a threat to the Cavaliers?
I feel like one more year of Cavalier dominance.
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, right now, like, let's say, you know, this, you know, the last day of the finals, you start talking a little bit about next year. You wonder, like, oh, like, a lot of people brought up OKC. You know, like, probably when the season was over, watch out for OKC next year. But I think one more year of dominance for the Cavs. And, you know, free agency will obviously play into that. Will Kevin Durant come to the East? You know, like, but is Atlanta going to make a jump? Is Toronto going to make a jump?
No, Atlanta,
like,
might break it up.
I don't see any of these guys making a jump. I mean, maybe Boston, if they could somehow get Jimmy Butler, but that's still, like, Jimmy Butler's not pushing you over Cleveland this season, but maybe next year, maybe the following season. But eventually LeBron has to slow down, right, Chris?
Like, yeah,
he can't just keep operating, even though mentally, like, when you watch LeBron, this is what I see. He's mentally head and shoulders above the rest of the league, mm-hmm. from a, like, understanding the game, when to insert himself. He doesn't get rattled on the road. You know, it's like, which we'll have to see this in the finals, because, like, the cakewalk he had to the finals was just, like, it was sort of embarrassing for the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, we've been, I mean, you make a good point about how long can LeBron kind of keep doing this, because we've seen those high school to pro players at this stage start to, you know, kind of slow down a little bit. I think it took Kobe a little bit longer. You know, he was still pretty good in his early 30s, really good, I guess you should say, in his early 30s. But, you know, the Jermaine O'Neals of the world, even KG, you know, a year or two after that. I mean, he's been playing LeBron since 18 years old in the NBA, and he's not been injured. Like, there's not been one of those years where he saved himself a little bit because of injuries. I know he's built like a Greek god, but at some point, right, it's got to happen. And I don't know when it is, but
I don't see it happening the following year. But I think, you know, like, I'm already projecting this finals going bad for Kevin Love. And, you know, like, listen, I could call it wrong, and he could have a great final. But I really see Kevin Love being a guy who has major trade value out there, and they're going to try to, like, make some manipulation. You know, like, does Kevin Love with LeBron James, does he do really that much more than Channing Frye? Like, I mean, he does a little bit, but, I mean, is it, you know, extra $20 million more? I don't know if it is. So I think you can see, like, them, going a different direction and maybe just getting like a team that's better fit for LeBron so he doesn't have to expend as much energy during the regular season. And then maybe they can get over the hump. But really, I think their window is this year. It could be this final or the following year, and that's it. I mean, like, how much longer could they stay on top unless he goes and – remember, he creates the banana boat team where it's like him, Carmelo, Chris mm-hmm. Paul, and Dwayne Wade and all those guys. Maybe that team could give it a shot one time, but I don't know. This seems like the window is closing. I think the following year they'll dominate, and that's it.
I feel like Cleveland might not accept this, but don't you think the Cavs – if it does go south in this series, if Kevin Love is the player that you're kind of suggesting there in this series, like they're almost better off getting like four quarters for a dollar for him, if you will, like getting a bunch of, like a Jay Crowder would be phenomenal with the Cavaliers right now.
Like, no, you're right. Even like this thing about like throwing those two names out there, could we follow that team? I mean, I do really closely, but Jay Crowder, Marcus Smart, that might be better.
Yeah.
That might be better. You know, like some more lineup versatility, more defensive versatility. Like, if you surround LeBron with tough, hard-nosed guys who can shoot threes, and tough, that's where LeBron really will have a good team. And, you know, it's not like, look, Kyrie is the man. So, like, I love Steph Curry, and I love Dame Lillard and watching these guys play, but I can watch Kyrie Irving play. Like, every minute he's out there, I love watching him play, too. I mean, I just think he has this a great feel for the game, you know, offensively, so... You know, you tough, hard-nosed guys that can play defense, you surround them with LeBron, they're going to be good. It's just the way it's going to go. Maybe four quarters for a dollar in the NBA, which never really works out for you. Maybe in this situation it does.
You know, players in Cleveland have often told me that when LeBron's yelling at Kyrie Irving, it's his kind of way of teaching. It's him. You know, Kyrie, for the first couple of years pre-LeBron, was just a scorer. Like, he was a one-dimensional kind of player. With LeBron there, he's got to obviously be much more. And LeBron gets out on him. It's sort of tough love out there. Is that? I mean, do you buy that? Do you think that's the?
Yeah,
that's what he's trying to do.
I think he looks at Kyrie as like a future superstar in the NBA, and you know, like he needs Kyrie to be the man, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, LeBron, more than any superstar out there, is like dying to get a guy who can carry the load with him. You know, like if Dwayne Wade wasn't so bad in that San Antonio series, I'm hard pressed to see LeBron go back to Cleveland. So. He wants Kyrie to be that guy. You know, the happiest I've ever seen LeBron. I mean, maybe during this playoffs he's been pretty happy, but in the David Blatt era, however long that was when Kyrie was dominating the Spurs in San Antonio. You see, like, LeBron was elated to see Kyrie and like going off on the Spurs, and he was absolutely going off, making tough shots over Kawhi, over Danny Green. So I think LeBron wants him to be the man. I don't feel the same way about Kevin Love. I feel like, you know, like he kind of treats Kevin Love like he treated Chris Bosh.
So we'll wrap it up here. You got Golden State in seven.
I do. And I like in a amazing two games, LeBron. Like, Kyrie's going to win them one, and LeBron and, like, company will win, like, two. You know, like, LeBron and somebody else will step up. But then in game seven, it'd just be too much Golden State.
Yeah, I got them in six. I got the Warriors in six.
You got them winning on the road again?
I just... When Cleveland gets down sometimes, just historically, is what I've seen, when they get down, they don't tend to band together. You know what I mean? Like, they don't unite in face
of
adversity.
What you're talking about. It's like LeBron drama. It's like, it's bad. I agree with you.
Like, you're not seeing, like, this group of guys, like, you know, come together. It's us against the world. They kind of point fingers at each other.
And I don't see how
and against a team at this level, you've got to almost be flawless. I mean, Oklahoma City was almost flawless. And they wind up losing that series. I just think they're in some trouble. If they go down 2-1 and get down like double digits in game four at home, like it might get ugly for the Cavaliers.
How do you see, like, here's the one thing that you got to take into account. So the road for LeBron has been, you know, fairly easy, right? So we know the rest, like, he's got 8 days off, 9 days off, whatever. Also, I think there's extra days in between the finals. Like, they put a lot of extra days in there. It's not how it used to be where it's like Thursday, Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, Sunday. There's days in there where LeBron can take extra. LeBron needs the rest more than anybody else out there. So I feel like he can bring that high level. Also, do you expect Cleveland to win one of two on the jump?
No.
Oh, so you got Warriors winning two.
I got them winning two.
So how do you expect the next two to go?
I think they win third game. I mean, that's just when teams do.
Yeah.
And then four is kind of a crapshoot to me. Like, four is high noon, you know, for the Cavaliers. Like, because it might, if they don't win four, it doesn't go back to six. It's just my thought on it. I mean, again, it goes back to my lack of faith of them kind of uniting when things get bad. Yeah. If they go down 2-0, it's like, you know, what do? They got a rookie coach. I like Ty Lue. I think Ty's a smart guy and deserved a head coaching job. But I don't see the same mental toughness. And you could comment on this because you were part of that team. Like that Boston team in 2007-08, you guys went like 7 games against Atlanta in the first round. Like that to me was a mentally tough team from the outside anyway.
Well, I will say that we didn't have LeBron, right? We didn't have the alpha male. We had like 4 alpha males. Like Rondo was a weird version of an alpha male. Pierce, Garnett, Ray Allen, they all thought they were alphas. So it was just one of those things. Like clearly the leader of Cleveland is LeBron. So it's almost like as he goes, they go. If he's playing well, he has energy, and then they're going to play well. I think the difference between the way we're seeing the series unfold is somehow I believe LeBron is going to figure out a way to get one game in Golden State. And that's why I got him going 7. I still have the Warriors winning, you know, figuring it out. But I really believe that LeBron is going to get one in Golden State in the first 2 games. I just see it going down like that. Because LeBron is the kind of guy that can navigate or attack a weakness of a team. You know, like he's sort of like a coach on the floor. He can make a slight adjustment to his game with players. So I see him getting one in Oracle, the first 2.
It's funny, like we say LeBron, and I said LeBron is, and that team kind of points fingers a little bit when they get down. It's considered pointing fingers now, but I wonder what it was like 25 years ago. Remember Bird when he called, what did he call his teammates, a bunch of women in the mid-1980s?
Everything's so blown out of proportion nowadays. You know, everybody's so sensitive, you know.
I don't know where the line, though, is, Scal. I mean, where's the line between, like, saying something to fire up your teammates and saying something – I guess you have to know your teammates and have your finger on the pulse. I guess Bird probably knew that his teammates would respond positively to being insulted, and maybe LeBron doesn't have the same type of guys.
Or Bird just didn't care, right? Or Jordan. Like, no, I'm serious. You know what I mean? Like Jordan, do you think he really cared? Do you really believe in your mind that he cared what his teammates thought?
No.
That's the biggest difference. Like, do you think LeBron cares?
Yeah.
I do, too.
Yeah.
I do, too. I think it's like there's an old school and a new school way. I think the new school way is like I think Draymond Green's an old school player. I think Draymond Green doesn't care what people think. I think like, you know, like Steph Curry probably does, or he does, you know, he does. LeBron cares what people think. Maybe not to an extent of, you know, he did 5 years ago, but as of right now, I think those old school guys were just like, it was like a totally different game. I really believe that. I'm not saying, I think the game now is better than it's ever been, but I think like the mindset, like the non-AAU culture, the different, you know, the way you grew up in your town and you hated the opponent, like all that stuff that really played into all that. It's not the same thing anymore. I'm not saying it's bad, Chris.
Yeah.
I think the game is at an all-time great level right now. And I think like the officials have do a good job. I think Adam Silver does a great job. I think a lot of good things about the NBA. I just think the players have a really different mindset.
Did the alpha males in Boston care what their teammates thought? Like did KG and Pierce and Ray and Rondo care what everyone thought?
Like I don't think Paul cared. I know Rondo didn't.
No, Rondo didn't give a damn.
He didn't care.
He was like 22 and didn't give a damn.
KG cares. Like, he really cares about his teammates, but in a positive. It's not like a negative way. It's not like, is this person going to like me or not? It's like he really cares. Like, he deeply cares about his teammates. And, yeah, I don't know. Ray was a hard one to really gauge. Like, great dude, and we hung out all the time and everything like that, but he was just a hard guy to gauge, like, whoa, are you care? Like, you are you the man? Are you not the man? Like, do you care? Do you not care? Like, it was really hard to gauge what Ray Allen was thinking at all times.
Scal, you're the best, man. Comcast Sportsnet, The Vertical, SiriusXM Radio. I appreciate it, man. It's been great.
All right, Chris, you have to take me out the Blue Apron. Oh!
Blue Apron one more time.
Get that mitt out of your oven. We'll talk later.
Thanks, Scal.
See ya.
You're the best. Thanks. Thanks for listening, everybody, and my thanks to Brian Scalabrine for joining the podcast. Remember, you can download this podcast and other archived episodes anywhere you can download podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, you name it, you can find it there. Also, make sure you check out The Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and The Vertical Podcast with Woj. We'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.